chance to have a dream, to open and run a bakery. But they took a chance, took the sweets to the street. Now they all have places where I'd love to eat.
Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up Podcast. I am your host, Mark Dick, and this is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and all the folks that work so hard, often through the night, to make the good stuff and share it with the people in their communities. It is good to talk to you today, let me tell you. Today I'm talking with David Applin and Camelia Pruel from Cliffside Hearth in Scarborough, Ontario. And I think I might have found, if not doppelgangers, if not full-on doppelgangers, at least kindred spirits in the baking world. And so we're gonna talk more about that. I'll set it up in a couple of seconds. Before then, how are you? How are you doing? How's the baking going this week? How's January treating you? I hope you're doing well. I hope everything's busy enough. I hope that enough of your customers have gotten over this foolhardy resolution stuff and are coming to get the good stuff at your bakery. Life's too hard to not have good baked goods. And the sooner these folks in January realize that, the better off we're all going to be. I wanted to let you know that in the next few weeks, I've got a couple of appearances coming up. I don't want to oversell my involvement in either, but I am going to be on a couple of things that I think you might find fun. So let me tell you about them. First off, on November 24th, I'm hosting a call over on bakersforbakers.org to do with subscriptions and subscription services at the bakery. This is a community-led thing. I'm going to be more or less facilitating it. But we're chatting about subscriptions. There's going to be folks there that are offering subscriptions, people that are curious about getting into it, talking about the pros and cons, things to watch out for, pitfalls to avoid, that kind of thing. It's coming up at Bakers for Bakers. And I also put a post up there just a few days ago talking about, why don't we do this every month? Why don't we talk about different things over at Bakers for Bakers on a call every month? And so we're starting to get the ball rolling with that, coming up with themes, things to talk about that I'll organize and we'll be announcing over there. So if you're a full-blooded member of the Bakers for Bakers community, awesome. Head over, check community calendar, and you'll find all about it. If you're not, hey, why not join? Bakers for Bakers is a free online community for professional bakers and bakery owners from all over the world, where we get together and talk about predominantly the business side of baking, some talk about the craft, and share when we have issues and when we have problems and when we have wins and things that worked and things that didn't work and all of that. It's a really nice community. It's a very kind and gentle and supportive community by intention. And so come on over. Don't be shy. We'd love to see you over there at Bakers for Bakers. That's with the number 4. .org, bakersforbakers.org. There you go. And then the following week, on the 30th of January, I'm going to be at the Baking Association of Canada Baker's Town Hall Gathering in Victoria. It's sponsored by the Baking Association of Canada. They're having it at Camosun College on Monday, January 30th from 3 to 5 p.m. It's going to be a bit of a meet and greet, a bit of a networking event, get a bit of a chance to meet fellow bakers and bakery owners from around the area, from Victoria and slightly further afield. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm working with Martin a little bit on this. We've got a bit of an agenda that we're pulling together, but its primary focus, as far as I'm concerned, is networking and meeting each other face-to-face and getting together and getting to know the people in your neighborhood in the baking world. So if you're there, if you're in the area and you want to come by, that's awesome. And be sure to come up and say hi, because I'm going to be nervous as all get out, wondering who's going to be there and do I know anybody and who am I going to meet? And in person, I'm incredibly shy. So come up and say hi. I would really appreciate that. If you want to get more information or click here to register, just head over to baking.ca And under chapter events, there's BC chapter activities, and it's the only one on there. So it's pretty easy. I'll try and put a link in the notes on this podcast as well, if that's what you want to do. So hope to see you there. Come out and say hi. It's going to be a lot of fun. All right. So David and Camelia, Cliffside Hearth, Scarborough, Ontario. Now, I don't know anything about Scarborough, except for the fact that it's home of the Bare Naked Ladies. And I recall that their cover of the Bruce Coburn tune, Lovers in a Dangerous Time, the video for that was shot driving around Scarborough. That's all I know about the town. But some friends of mine, Megan and Graham, said, you really need to check out Cliffside Hearth. Check out their website. Talk to these folks. They're killing it at their bakery in a strip mall in Scarborough. And so I did. And we had a great talk. Turns out Dave is a former musician, and he talks about that a little bit, and then we get into things. So I looked him up, right? It's like, oh, former musician. And I think he is just a little bit older. Well, I know he's older than me, and just that right amount older, so that he was playing music when I was listening to music, if that makes sense. And I saw a couple song credits and stuff for singers like Lee Aaron, who was really popular back in the 80s, and I was a big fan. And now I know that David, my new best bud in the baking world, also played guitar on some Lee Aaron songs. So that's pretty cool. So a lot of this talk is about connections and how we've kind of known each other. We've kind of run parallel existences over the years for at least the last 12 or 13 or 14 years. But then when I was looking up his musical background, it's like, maybe we crossed paths even earlier. So that was kind of cool. Very entertaining couple. Sounds like their bakery in Scarborough is just wicked good. And I was excited to talk to them, and we had a really good chat. So let's get into it with David Applin and Camelia Pruel from Cliffside Hearth in Scarborough, Ontario. So I'm so glad to meet you guys, and I've been kind of sniffing around your website and found your old blog and that kind of stuff. And it was like, I you know, never met before. And I think, oh my gosh, I think we have a lot in common because.
Yeah. The website and all social media have kind of, they've lapsed. There was since the pandemic, I guess I can blame that, but I kind of lost interest in, there's a lot of content that you have to provide when you do it yourself. And so I think after a while, you know, I lost interest, especially with the social media stuff. And I lurk now. I just don't do as much posting. And I thought, you know, if we suffer from this, it means I'm going to have to go back and create content, but I don't notice it. So I've just kind of left it.
Yeah.
I focus on the baking.
And I think these days, if you're going to succeed in that space, you have to learn how to dance, which is something yes. I can't do. So,
yeah. And
you have to learn how to dance, and you have to have time to dance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. You know it. No, well, it's because, so I was talking over the holidays, I was talking with my friends, Megan and Graham in Arnprior. Megan was on the show. That's Mighty Fine Bakehouse is their place. And we were just gabbing about life. I hadn't talked to her in a couple of years. And because we met at a little grain fest thing out in Montreal, 2018, I think.
And you went,
We were out at that. Or I was out at that, yeah. And it was funny because, well, and so she said, yeah, you know, there's two folks you really need to talk to. They've got this bakery. It's like it's in a strip mall in Scarborough, but they're just killing it. Like they're doing like great, great stuff out of this strip mall in Scarborough. And then when I saw pictures of the outside of your place, it just reminded me so much of Orange Boot Bakery, like my place place in Regina, you know, in a strip mall where you wouldn't expect it, but it's like you're making the good stuff. And I thought, oh, we've got kindred spirits here. And then when I saw you were doing when you got your start with a wood-fired oven, then I thought, well, we have real kindred spirits. So, yeah.
That's now, the wood-fired thing is so far, in my mind at least, in the past that, like, it's almost, wow. You know, I don't knock anybody for doing it, obviously. But it's a really, really intense experience building it, running it, and you know, even just firing it.
Yeah.
And then baking out of it. I think in most cases, when you're a newbie, you start that up and then you realize what you've gotten into. And man, is it ever, it is so labor intensive, and it's, yeah, you know, medieval. And it's,
yeah.
So yeah, I don't regret it. It was a lot of fun. And you know what, that oven that stood in our backyard is now gone. And, you know, I remember building and thinking, oh, it's going to be there, you know, it's going to be there when I'm gone. But we redid our backyard a couple of years ago, and we hadn't used it. Like, I think almost to the day that, you know, when we moved up to the bakery where we're at now, like to the retail space, it never got used. I think I maybe fired it once for some pizza, and that was it.
Yeah.
And I stuffed it full of wood, and the wood was dry, and I never put a match to it again. And, you know, so I guess that says something. You know, there's pressing the button to start up whatever it's, whether it's gas or electric. That's why all this stuff was invented.
Yeah, no, I hear you. When we opened our bakery, I never touched the wood fired oven until we closed our bakery. Like, as you know, maybe one pizza party, and I got to enjoy the wood fire thing after we closed Orange Boot, because it was sort of like, well, I need to do something. I may as well get some wood and fire it up again. But yeah, but when you're in the when you're in the thick of it, yeah, that's it takes a lot. It takes too much time on the few hours you have off to get the oven up to temp and do something.
Yeah, and you know, cold Canadian winters. The cold Canadian winters, I just remember baking when it was 20 below.
Yep.
And like, we never had any arrangement outside other than sawhorses set up. Mm-hmm. So our bake kitchen was about maybe 10 feet away. So everything would be shunted out. And no matter the weather, like if it was, we got it all in, and it was really insane. Lots and lots of fun, but you know, the stress level, wow. Like, you know, just cause when you build doughs and they're set and you want to get them into the oven without destroying them. It was really crazy.
Yeah.
The wood fired oven was, we did that for 5 full years.
Wow.
So it wasn't just a temporary thing. It got quite serious, where we were doing some fairly large bakes on the weekends, mm-hmm, while we were maintaining our day jobs.
Yeah.
So doing that for 5 years, and the last 8 months running that oven, we actually held 3 wholesale accounts. So before we decided to open a retail store. Just to kind of test the waters, you know?
Yeah. Tell me about why baking for you guys. If you had day jobs and all of that stuff, what got you into this craziness?
So my background has been the restaurant industry.
Okay.
But not in the kitchen side of it. Front of house management. And for David, well,
I worked in the in-store bakery at Loblaws for 25 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I actually had a career, well, not a career. I bounced around in other bakery jobs prior to that for maybe, I don't know, close to 10 years. I was from the early 80s onwards, like, even before that, like, I was a rock and roll musician.
Oh, really?
The time, like, I'm 64 now, so the time I came up and had my so-called career, which is mainly playing in bar bands, playing, you know, across the country and a little bit in the States. By the time the early 80s and the mid 80s in particular rolled around, I guess I was about mid-20s, and the life on the road, and also my prospects were, you know, it's a young man's game, and it sounds funny to say at 26, but it's really like that in the music business. When you get to that age,
you
start being ignored, and I could see that coming. And so the money that you can make just goes down, and so I had to start, you know, just like a typical rock and roller who had to get kicked off the couch and go out and get like a so-called real day job. I guess culinary was in at least in Toronto in the mid 80s, it was easy to get jobs like that, and you could, you know, make a sort of a living and bounce around, and that's kind of what I did. I worked in some industrial places. I worked in some small pastry shops, but eventually I wound up at Loblaws. You know, union, higher wages, it's all that job security
and benefits.
And I wound up being offered the opportunity of going through an apprenticeship program. So, you know, 4 years of community college in Toronto at the time was George Brown. A really, really good European teachers that were the community college thing was with tenured instructors at that time, so it was very stable. I learned great skills, and you know, I was very, very lucky that my employer, like Loblaws, was paying me to. I was making a weekly wage, whereas some of my co-students, you know, they weren't. They were pursuing it independently and starving. So, you know, I after the apprenticeship, you go back in the stores, and I think the intention of the company was to groom bakers to be bakery managers and ascend into maybe the corporate side of it. You know, at least middle management, and that never interested me. So I just stayed a baker.
Oh, okay.
And that's long back when Loblaws was a scratch bakery.
Yeah, that's right. They hadn't been a scratch bakery. Really, only a couple of years after I finished the apprenticeship did they make that definitive switch over to par bake.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and it was done incrementally, but it got to the point where, you know, several years in, it was not baking. It
right.
was toast. You're maybe a toastmaster.
Yeah.
You know, you heat stuff up, but and by the time I left, there was no flour in the bakeries and certainly no yeast.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah. And so it's kind of a, you know, when you have knowledge of the baking process and all the aspects that you must engage with as a scratch baker, it's de-skilling. And you resent it. And so I labored under those conditions for actually quite a long time before I sort of, I guess, got off my ass in a bunch of different ways. Read a book. I think that my cousin had a copy of The Bread Baker's Apprentice, that Peter Brown had. And that really, that's I was already starting to do home baking because we had a son by then. And you know, I was just baking bread for the three of us, you know, on a really small scale. And that caught my interest. And so I started exploring stuff. And it led to the Alan Scott, Daniel Wing book, The Bread Builders. And from that point, it was off and running. I had to build an oven. You know, like I've always been a doer. I have absolutely no experience or expertise in masonry.
Yeah.
But that didn't stop me. And it was really, I'm glad that I got to interact with Alan. You know, I didn't know even at the time that I got in touch with him, his health wasn't that good. Mm-hmm. And he never made it out of, I don't know, was it 2009 that he died? It was a long
time. Yeah, it was something like that. Yep. Yep.
But I know that he really influenced a whole pile of people worldwide to get into this idea of, you know, small is beautiful, the slow food movement, all that type of stuff. I mean, I, 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 I didn't, I didn't follow any of it really, other than building the oven.
Mm-hmm. And which was built in what year?
2005. That's when we built the oven.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, so that's sort of how we got to, you know, like the background. And sorry to go on, but
it's good. It's so neat. Well, I guess first off, it's just remarkable because Bread Baker's Apprentice was the one that got me going again. I remember I saw it at the library. And as soon as I read about like baker's percentages, I thought, oh, okay, this is something completely different. Cause that was the first book I read that was actually, you know, had formulas over recipes,
yes,
kind
proper
of thing.
Formulas.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it was the Alan Scott thing. I built my, I went to a workshop with Alan in 2004, and then 2006 was when I built mine. So it's like right around the same time.
Yes.
Wow. That's great.
Time frame and stuff. Yeah. You know, when I built mine, you know, I still have the emails from him where I couldn't figure out how to do the chimney, you know, and
yes,
because choking it down. And he sent me a PDF file of a hand sketch that he did.
Yes.
Like, you know, it was the 2004 version of a fax, you know, and I got this thing and it was yes, I understand. Okay, good. You know,
I have all my papers that were emailed or faxed from him. And I actually, I lent them to a guy, a much younger, I don't call him a kid. He's a man, but, there's a fellow that came and visited us, at our retail mm-hmm. store not long after we opened. And, you know, he was a breadhead, so you know we bonded over wood-fired ovens, and he had a plan, quixotic plan, but he's still at it.
Yeah,
he moved with his partner, his girlfriend, I guess, up north of Toronto into some rural location, built an oven, and I believe they're growing the wheat that they grind to make the bread. So like he went many, many more layers deep. I couldn't ever. And I've only spoken to him a few times, but he does call me about once every year or two. We have a conversation on the telephone and he's still at it. And you know, it's all about up in the smaller towns. It's all about farmers markets. So he's done really, really well.
Good.
So I'm, you know, because, you know, with the hard work, you know, adding the extra work of plowing a field and growing,
harvesting your own
grain. I can't even imagine that.
But, no.
You know, he's got the years. Like Camille and I, when we started all this, we were, you know, I was in my late 40s when we built the oven, and I was in my early and mid 50s when we opened the retail store. So. And she's, you know, she's a few years younger than I am, but we're not spring chickens. And we're just, she was saying earlier, you know, if we had started this when we were really young and stupid, like when we were in our 20s or 30s, imagine
where we would be now.
Yeah. If you have ambition when you could really go to town. And I know there's lots of examples across mm-hmm. our country and certainly across the United States, even more down there. But
I don't believe that we would have been able to commit ourselves so much time to our retail store had we done it when we were younger, having a child to raise. That would have been very challenging and probably not so great for our son. At least when we started out with this, when it was a home project. And we were just baking for the community. That in itself, he was able to participate a little bit, and it was at least we were at home. Together. Now we are like opposite shifts work. David's in there at night with a couple lads. Well, our son works there part time, and then I'm there in the daytime doing sort of the sweet side of it and the, you know, the pies and the croissants and the cookies and squares and tarts. This stuff is all done in the daytime.
Right.
So David manages the bread aspect of it in the evening. And then And then between us, the wholesale gets delivered in the morning. So we work some opposite hours, and we make it work because we're all adults now. You know, our son is university, you know, age. And so it would have been really challenging if we had done it when we were younger, but we probably would have been in a different place now, you know, because, you know, we can feel it. There's no doubt that baking is a real physically demanding work, and it tires you right out. So we're just coming off of a week of holidays. We've been off for, I guess, 9 days now.
Yes, feels like about 90 days, which is nice.
Yes, it feels so, like we've been gone from our job forever. Just having 1 week, it's like, wow, what a treat.
Yeah, this is the week that Cindy and I would sneak away to Victoria. We live out here now, but that was, you'd close the bakery after New Year's.
Is Victoria your getaway?
That way it was for us. Yeah. Yeah. When we had Orange Boot, we started coming out to the coast. If we could get away for a long weekend in Vancouver or 3 or 4 days in Victoria,
right?
You know, we'd been out pre-bakery, you know, camping and stuff out here, but,
yep.
It was just like, okay, we got to get out of town for a bit. Cause then I'm sure it's similar for you. You know, you're exhausted. You finally shut down after the holidays, and you want to spend time sort of planning and setting up for the next year. But before you do that, like we just had to get away, like just take off and leave the kids and just spend like 4 days wandering about and try to tour the bakeries that stayed open.
Yeah, yeah. You know what? I remember looking you up now.
Oh yeah.
Your travel blog.
There was
a fantastic travel blog. And you know, like the problem when you can Google and you have so many interests that stuff just comes and goes, and I apologize for that. I should have been following that a lot more religiously, because I remember thinking, wow, I was very impressed by it. Yeah.
Thanks.
Had the wherewithal to travel in Europe, and you know, like traveling in Europe is they say it's small, and it's small as compared to Canada, but you know, it's still a big landmass.
Oh yeah.
And to go from country to country, that's really something. That requires planning and itinerary and all kinds of stuff.
That's so cool that you read that. Yeah, like and that it ties back to the bakery, because we went on that trip after we closed Orange Boot, and it was always the joke that it was funny when we weren't tired between the two of us, was all of our customers would always come into the bakery and flag us down because they'd been on these wonderful trips. And it's like, I want to tell you about this bakery in Paris I went to. I want to tell you about this thing in Spain. And we were like, not only will we never go because we don't have the time, we can never afford it. Like how are we ever going to go to Paris? And so when we got the offer to buy all of our stuff and we closed, Cindy, well, that was the first thing she said is, some of this money is for a trip because we're never going to have it again. And so we took off. Yeah. But when we had the bakery, I was always doing this newsletter for customers, right? Like about once a month, I'd send an email newsletter and tell them what we're doing at the bakery or tell them a goofy story. And people liked that. And so when they heard we were going on this trip, a couple of them said, well, you're going to be writing about your trip, aren't you? And I was like, oh, okay, I guess so. So we set the blog up, and I figured out how to post from the road and stuff. And like every 2-3 days would do a post. I think I did 17 in all on that trip.
Wow.
Is the blog still up?
It's not, because I had to let some hosting go, but I still have it all. And I'm trying to, I have this project that I'm to go through it and repost it on my new webs, like my personal site now.
Sure.
It's all there, but, the translation, I have all the photos, but they all left the posts. And so I have to put the photos back and I have to put paragraphs back, because I just have the words, like a big stream of words.
Reassemble it.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to format it all. So that's one of my projects. Cause,
so did you sell your bakery?
Yes, kind of. So what happened was there was a chain of coffee shops, like a local chain. They had like four or five locations and they were looking for kitchen space. And like, because they were setting up these locations that didn't have kitchens. And so they offered to buy, like take over our lease, buy everything in place and run their coffee shop bakery out of that space. And so, and so we said, okay, because we were, well, and I want to get into this with you folks because and understand, see how, if it's happened to you as well, but what we were getting tired out, rebuilding teams. It seemed like every year or so, every 18 months, we'd have a lot of changeover with staff and, and especially in Regina back then, there wasn't a real baking scene or everything. So we were training everyone from first principles. Like we had, you know, our best, most experienced bakers, you know, had a very little bit of experience or were fresh out of school or something like that. Yeah. And so we just found it exhausting. And so we were like you, we were both working full shifts and our parents were getting older and stuff. And we were like, you know, if one of us gets sick or one of the parents gets sick and we have to care for them, I don't know how this business runs. And so when the offer came to buy us out, we thought, okay, we'll take it. We're going to replan all this, redesign it. And if we reopen, it's going to be something that we can sustain a little bit better. Yeah. Cause we were just run off our feet. And then after a couple of months, Cindy cracked first and she said, I don't think I want to do this again. You know, like, I, you know, and then I get it. And so we got really lucky, you know, like, because we realized that the two of us make a heck of a team, but we didn't want to do this again when we didn't have the, well, and what do I do with this massive oven and mixer and all of that? And I could barely get it into the space. How am I going to get it out? That kind of thing.
I remember seeing, when you opened Orange Boot, I remember the process of the oven being delivered.
Oh my God.
And going into, because it was right around the same time. We were doing something similar. It was a different oven. It was a build rather than a complete oven going into situ.
Yeah.
But I could identify with the excitement, particularly of, you know, getting the nicest shiny toy.
Yeah.
The equivalent of a Cadillac, basically.
And
at least in terms of price.
Oh, for sure. And and that was Cindy and her dad. I was still working at Sastel and I was at work all day getting text updates as they got it through. And then I saw the video after because she was filming steps as she went. It's that's still up on YouTube, that one. But that's so cool because you're right. The timing, because you opened sort of towards the end of 2011. Yeah.
Yeah. No, we opened in April of 2011.
Oh, and we were January of 2011. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. My last day of work was March 17th, like St. Patrick's Day.
Uh-huh.
And that was a Friday. And you know, at Loblaws, you know, Saturday's a regular day of business. So I had requested a leave of absence, which I can talk freely about now, but for a long time I had to be really careful about that because I was doing it, it was a sly move to hedge my bets, I guess. I asked for a 6-month leave of absence with no pay.
Yeah.
And it was granted and with almost no, I think the store manager came up to me one time and he said, do you mind if I ask you why you're taking this leave of absence? And you don't have to answer me, Dave. It's okay.
Yeah.
I'm just curious. And I said, and I was really, I was right on the spot, right?
Yeah.
It's not him that determines whether I get it or not. It's someone much higher up in a different department. But I just said, you know, something very blithe, like, oh, my wife's opening a cafe and I'm just going to help her out. And, you know, like, and that was the end of it. Like they never, and so, you know, fast forward to near the end of that 6-month period when we were already, you know, elbow deep in this new experience. And it was seeming, you know, like I was not going to go back. That was obviously the plan to begin. But I got a telephone call from my bakery manager, and he said, the store manager has a copy of this, of the Globe and Mail, and you guys are, you know, like the Globe and Mail did a piece on us in August of 2011.
Yeah.
Which was really, really fortuitous. And so obviously I couldn't hide it anymore, right? And so I had to formally quit at that point. I had to go back and say, and write a letter of resignation and quit. And it was, and it's, you know, and I never looked back, although, you know, you leave Loblaws, but Loblaws doesn't leave you. So any, and that would go for any long-term, you know, job or vocation that anyone would have. You don't, just because you walk away with it doesn't mean that you forget about it. So, and I have a lot of friends, and I work with a lot of really great people over the years, especially all those German bakers. Holy cow.
I did a very similar thing. I got a leave of absence from SaskTel, although when you're opening up a bakery, there's no worry about conflict of interest. But I had this, and it was my fallback position, was that if the thing's not working, I'll be able to get it running. Like, I'll hire bakers and I'll get it running. I'll go back to my old job and we'll live off my old job while this bakery, I don't know, somehow makes money on its own. That was the dumbest part of the entire plan. Like, that was ever going to happen. But it gave me the confidence that I could make the leap anyways, you know?
Yes. Yeah. I'm just thinking it probably served the same function with me.
Yeah.
Like, I was pretty sure that after 6 months, like, Christ, I thought that it would be obvious after, you know, a month or even less. If this thing is going to crash, it's going to crash really fast, but it didn't. And, you know, we muddled our way through. And I think a lot of it is just sort of like, you know, we wrote a business plan and it was very detailed. But, you know, we folded up and put it in our back pocket. And it was sort of that was also, I think, a confidence builder, you know, to go through all those processes of, you know, like, you need to know some notion of numbers.
Yeah.
I'm not as much, I'm not a numbers guy at all, except for Excel and Baker's formulas, but Camellia is very detailed numbers oriented. So we have benefited from that. In fact, I could say that if it was me, you know, like, I'm just a baker that bakes bread. Like, there's, you know, like, guitar players, a dime a dozen. There's so many, and especially now, like, there's a lot of, you know, there's lots of bakers out there, but running the, you know, the, what lies underneath it that makes it successful enough that you and I define success on a very, you know, modest scale, being able to run a household and, you know, drive a car and that, you know, that you're not in debt. At least to any great extent, as opposed to, you know, like, I don't think we've ever got to the point where we could ever consider even a second location, never mind scaling up to, you know, to multi-locations or franchising or anything. And that was never the goal. The goal was just to simply, you know, replace one bakery job at a chain supermarket with another one. And so it's been okay.
Yeah. Well, and it says right on your website on the main page there, one location to serve you better. So I like that.
Oh, yeah, I have to tell you, I stole that.
That's okay.
I there's a little story with that. There's we both grew up in Ottawa.
Okay.
That's where I'm from Toronto, but I grew up in Ottawa. Camille's from Ottawa. So we go back there fairly regularly, and we were just up there for part of our post-holiday, and there's a little pizza joint on kind of a rundown area of town. It's called Eastview Pizza, and it's been there for 50 years. Like, Eastview is now called Vanier. Vanier is sort of this little city in the middle of Ottawa, and it was formerly called Eastview. So it's called Eastview because it was the area it's in was called Eastview when it was open. So and it's very run down. But they make everything. They make pizza, they make burgers, shawarma, poutine, everything. And on their takeout menu, that's what it says. one location to serve you better. And I thought, I like that. Sort of the anti-growth thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's like the old Vinyl Cafe episodes about Dave's Record Shop. Hey, we're not big, but we're small. Yeah.
We're small. Exactly. If I could have used that, I would have.
Yeah. Yeah. He probably trademarked it though. So yeah. Camelia, what has the bakery changed much in the 10 plus years since you've had it? Like you're doing retail suites and stuff. What's it like there?
Originally we started out and David said, oh, we're just going to do bread. That's it. Just bread. And it was not, and we ended up doing some cookies at the beginning. And then it morphed into tarts and squares and then cinnamon buns and then croissants. And then it got into some sweet and savory pies. So we apple crumbles, pumpkin pies, rhubarb. Then it got into cheesecake in small, small numbers. Quiches on the weekend. So now, and then quiches were always selling. So now we sell them from the freezer. So you can get them fresh once a week or you can buy them frozen during the week. So tortillas, I'm French Canadian. So the year of the ice storm, we were doing tortillas just at Christmas.
That was 2013, by the way. That was in Toronto.
Yeah.
Toronto,
and, you know, a lot of people missed out on doing their Christmas dinners because people in the community were without power for, you know, 5 days, 6 days. A lot of people came in after Christmas. Oh, my God, we didn't get a chance to have tortillas. Would you think about doing tortillas in January so that we could get our tortilla? So then we decided, you know what, people buy meat pies year round.
Right.
So now we just, tortillas sell year round. So I grew up in Ottawa, but my family, my parents were both born in the province of Quebec.
Right.
So I'm from a French Canadian family. And my mother, she was born and raised on a farm about an hour northeast of Ottawa on the Quebec side of the Ottawa River. And that property still remains in our possession now. There's 100 acres of land there.
Wow.
And that land is farmed mainly for feed, but a small portion of it still gets plowed every year for a vegetable garden. And the vegetables get harvested and some of the items that are preserved come to us to sell in the bakery.
Oh, lovely.
So there's jams and pickles and antipasto. This is coming from Quebec, from our family that's doing this. And we sell that up at the bakery. So there's condiments for the tortilla, jams for the bread, and pickles for the burgers. We make brioche buns, so we sell a lot of brioche buns. And this year was our first year to have some garlic braids.
Oh,
my brother grew a lot of garlic, so second year of harvest, so he was willing to sell some of it, and it was an amazing crop. So they braided up garlic braids, so we're selling those in the bakery. Yeah, so just, you know, and a lot of like small quantity, small batch.
Mm-hmm.
We are small batch. We do wholesale, but we are small batch. We sell one type of olive oil, a Spanish olive oil that's also from a small batch producer where not very many places are selling this product. I think only three in Toronto. So we have, you know, a handful of unique little products available. We also make soup. We don't sell it hot, like daily, but we sell it some vegetarian soups, like a lentil soup and a squash soup that we have always available in the freezer. And
that's
constantly moving because of, you can see the desire and the need for prepared foods.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's where I see, you know, the quiches and the meat pies. We also do a beef bourguignon pie. Mm-hmm. So we make a beef bourguignon stew and then bake it into pastry. So these are some sort of unique offerings that are available. Our bakery is tiny. It's only 740 square feet.
Oh my goodness. You're doing you a lot of there.
I think your place, Orange Boot, being about 1500.
It was 1200 on the lease anyways. And I think that 1200, and then we just had a tiny area at the front. Like we didn't have seats or anything. It was just, it's just a place to stay warm while you're at the counter.
Yeah.
And the rest of it was kind of all production.
If you get a handful of people in the front of our bakery, because our retail space is tiny, if you put six or eight people in the front of the store, it's packed.
Yep.
So because the space is, and it's open concept, so beyond the counter, it is all production. So, and you can see everything that's going on.
For better or for worse.
For better or for worse. So, yes. So, I mean, mainly the bread production is taking place at night, and the breads are all baked in the morning for store opening so that they can get out the door for delivery as well. So the production that people see during the day is small. It's, you know, the baking of sweet goods. We do individual pizzas, garlic sticks, these sort of items. They're all done very last in the morning. And any sweet goods that need to be baked off or made, slabs of brownies or blondies, those are all done in the morning, before noon. Usually by the afternoon, the oven is off, and it's only, all it is we're selling the goods.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. Selling the goods and then cleaning up the shop. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds really, really similar. Although, like, David, what kind of shift are you and your bread crew working then? Like, what hours are you there?
My hours are usually somewhere in the vicinity of 2 a.m. 2 a.m. till 9. I'm out the door at 9:30.
Gotcha.
O'clock at the latest. Every year I've worked there, it's been, you know, just sort of trying to take something that was possibly multi-steps and just ruthlessly eliminate steps.
Yeah.
Into right down to the, you know, like without compromising
quality.
Without compromising quality or making it, making it slapdash. I also don't want that. I want a fast flow, but purposeful and highly integrated.
Mm-hmm.
So now, you know, so that's my goal. I haven't quite attained it, but the elimination of steps. I every corner that I can cut, you know, like I said, without. That I can justify that I can cut, I will.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a nice thing, you know, not having to answer memos from head office, to be somewhat in control of your destiny. Now, you know, the government steps in and puts a kibosh. Your landlord can step in and put a kibosh on that. But barring that, you know, it's smooth sailing for nobody says you can't make that. If you want to make it and if you can sell it, go for it, you know?
Yeah. Well, and yeah, it's so I've got a pretty good mental image, I think, of your place and sort of how it would work. I think at Orange Boot, we had a little bit more overlap because during the middle of the week anyways, we never started till about 4. So there was the bread took a little bit longer and the sweets overlapped with the bread for a while and then kind of go. But that same kind of a thing, you know, it's like get the bread in and out. Well, but we didn't have wholesale. So I just had to have it all out by 10 o'clock kind of a thing.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah. And you just kind of you got your crew working the bread and your crew getting prepped up for the next day or baking off the
spot. Yes. So I start at 2, and then the young lads usually come in at around 4 or 5.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's elastic. So if it's a Thanksgiving or a Christmas, then there'll be just a few days. But we've got it down to a point now where if I'm asking them to come in early, I'm only asking them to come in an hour early. So come in for 3 instead of 4, as if that makes any difference to a young guy that's got to drag his ass out of bed.
But sometimes there's like at Easter, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on hot cross buns.
Yeah.
So now you're getting into, some more labored in production that is going to take up time that might have been used on breads or rolling out baguettes. And again, if it's a special holiday, like at Christmas, the numbers just go up and up. And if you're doing things like, you know, adding on a lot of additional baguettes, then you need the labor there to start rolling these things out in order to get them out, to get them delivered. Right. So there, the added products at the holiday times of the year, of course, changes all the work schedule.
Oh, sure. Sure.
So, at Christmas, we do a lot of stuff, seasonal items like fruitcake and stollen. And then, you know, all the shortbread and the gingerbread package stuff that we make. But that doesn't usually change the hours of production, because a lot of that stuff can be done in the daytime. But it's more like any dough-related products that are added. Like I say hot cross buns because it's the first one that comes to my mind at Easter, where everybody's got to have their hot cross buns.
I don't know what it is west or east, west of Ontario, or even west of East Toronto, for that matter. Where in our neighborhood, there is a demand for hot cross buns that is going to start probably tomorrow.
Oh, wow. Like,
we're going to go back.
Yeah, people start asking. They're going to start asking us
in January. So when are you going to ask?
It must be the age of our clientele.
Yeah.
And some people don't realize, well, the hot cross bun is an Easter thing. So, I mean, I get people asking for them at Christmas time. And then we go, well.
A lot of grocery stores do them year round.
We did
that at Loblaws. And it sort of, and when we first started, I sort of followed that, and then I thought, no, we're gonna, this is no good. Like, I
suppose we'll stick with tradition and just do them.
At Easter, but there's such strong pushback in the form of demand. Like, so, you know, like on the 9th or 10th day of January, we're gonna get at least a few people that are gonna say that same thing that they say every year, and we're gonna say the same thing. Not until March 1st. And even if Easter isn't until, you know, sometimes Easter is really in late April, that'll be like a month and a half of doing hot cross buns. I don't know where they put
them. What I was going to say is that one thing in our, when you're talking about visiting all these bakeries in Europe, and we were talking about the size of our shop being 740 square feet, for several years now, we have felt it quite a challenge at certain times of the year
to exist in our space, to function,
because, you know, there's the walk-in fridge is only so large. And when you've got all those doughs and you're needing to make sure the temperature, you know, the proofing time and temperature is correct for everything, definitely a challenge. And when we first started looking for a bakery space, we were looking for about 1500 square feet. So here we settled on a space that was half the size because we wanted to be close to home.
Okay.
We thought, we're older, we want to not have to travel.
We're a kilometer away.
I was working in downtown Toronto and traveling into the downtown every day. We wanted to be close to home, even close enough to walk if we could. We wanted 1500 square feet, but we couldn't find that size of a space in a retail format where it was on a busy street, where we had a storefront, you know, that was main floor. So, and just, of course, some of the other needs, like the type of power. We needed 3-phase power. We didn't want a basement. So there, with all the logistics, we crammed ourselves into this small space, and we've never been able to expand out on either side of our location. So we've managed, and we went to France. Was it the first year?
In 2012, we went over to France in the summertime.
And we went to a lot of bakeries. We were in Paris, and then we went to Aix, and then to the south, and we went to a lot of bakeries. And the common factor there that we saw was how small most of the bakeries were and how functional they were for the size of space was quite amazing.
They manage.
They manage, they yes. Manage. And
they arrange things and they manage.
So we came home to remind ourselves after that trip that, you know, if they can do it, surely we can do it. Our space is much larger than many of the bakeries we saw. So here we are 12 years down the road, still in the same bakery space.
I'm curious, are there any innovations that you've come up with that to make more efficient use of the space? Anything you do that
everything has to earn its space for sure.
There you go.
And there's a lot of use of vertical space.
Yeah, I'm tall, so I'm constantly reaching and climbing up, you know, so shelves all over the place.
If we are to add anything in, we have to hum and haw and you know, discuss it back and forth. We got a dough divider rounder a couple years ago. I guess that was during the pandemic we did that.
Yep.
And it had to earn its footprint for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah, and you just
we don't have a sheeter. We do all the pastries rolled by hand.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, that's another piece of equipment that we often go,
It'd be nice to have.
It'd be nice to have because my arms can feel it, but
yeah.
But
you need but you need space. And
yes, you need to have the space for it. So,
yeah.
So yes.
You could do like me and I bought a used sheeter and kind of didn't really understand how big it was going to be till I got it in the space and realized we had to keep the wings up most of the time or else it was when you wanted to use it, it was very difficult to get into the walk-in while somebody's using the sheeter because the wing came sort of where the door door was. And because I was off by about 18 inches on what I needed.
yeah.
We measured our place out almost to the inch.
Yeah.
You know, using Excel, even though Excel it's not designed for that, but that's what I used it for.
Yeah.
That's all I had. It's all I knew. And, but you know, like you also paint yourself into a corner with that too, because, you know, you make it or we did make it so we could fit in the gear that we had then.
Yeah.
And yeah, so there was no way to expand, with equipment in terms of things like sheeters, things that you might not start with, but you might, you know, you might want that you find desirable down the road. And that, so that's been an issue, but you know, what can you do? If we were younger, maybe we would relocate, but
yeah. Well, and I was going to ask who's beside you in the mall there.
There's a bar on one side.
Okay.
And there's a natural path on the other side. So, it works, but it barely works because that's
so the bar actually does not have really much activity in the daytime. It's like a small pub,
right?
You know, with a small food menu, but they seem to have mainly their business is in the evening, and we're grateful for that because you know it's a mixed bag of clients, that patronize. That patronized the pub, and so I'm actually happy that they have more of their business in the evening because it's less for us to deal with in our storefront space.
Yeah.
Because you get the drinkers, you get the smokers. I mean, we're a bakery. Do you want to have people standing around smoking cigarettes in front of your bakery? No, right? You know, we're going for very, very different scents there.
Yeah.
Hey Mark, did you have neighbors when you ran Orange Boot?
Oh yeah. Yeah. So our strip mall, we were on the corner and it was like a U-shaped one. Yeah, it was a U. And so we were on the one end, sort of on the street side. And then right beside us was the real estate office and also the guy that owned the mall. Like it was his real estate
company. Your landlord.
Yeah, the landlord as well. And so for 5 years, there was this debate on whether or not he was going to give us more space. And whenever we thought we needed more space and we might take another, you know, go 10 feet that direction kind of a thing, then he didn't want to do it. And then whenever I was like ready to chuck the whole thing in, then he was ready to give us more space. And so we never did line up on that. But there was there were some very helpful things. There was a daycare, there was a dentist office, there was a nonprofit that were very supportive of us. And then we had it was called Sparky's. It was the bar and pizza place. Same kind of thing. They were dead in the daytime. And when we were in, especially Saturday mornings, when we're working earlier at the nighttime, we'd have to call a few cabs for folks and have a few people scare the heck out of you by staring in the window when you're, when it's dark outside and you can't see them until they're right there. So we had a few adventures, but it wasn't too terrible, you know, but it was just, and then being in Saskatchewan and being, you know, in a strip mall like that, it was all about parking. So, can we get a couple of spots for customers, or is every real estate agent going to park right in front of the bakery to run in and not sell houses or whatever they do when they're at the office? So it was always this big tension about parking spaces, but it was okay. You know,
we've fortunately not had really an issue with that because there's an open area where there's a lot of parking.
It's nice.
And then there's a small amount of parking directly in front, half a dozen spaces. And then directly around the corner at the side of the building, there's more parking. So and I find, too, with the bakery, a lot of people pull up in front, run in, grab their baguette and off they go. Whereas, for the pub or the natural path, that they're parking for much longer. And then there's a nail salon on the other side of the pub, which, of course, people go in there for a longer period of time. But there are two major banks in the plaza, the
Scotia
and the CIBC. So they also have the problem with people stopping out front, running in to use the machine. And there's also an LCBO, but it's at the other end of the plaza. There's quite a few shops, like the Shoppers Drug Mart is plunk in the center, so it's out where the big parking lot is.
Gotcha.
So people, you know, going there are parking over in that area.
That's actually pretty cool, though. It sounds like it's a there's a lot of stuff going on where you are. So I'd imagine that's going to bring you a lot of traffic, eh?
It's a hub. Yeah.
Nice.
There's also a Service Ontario around the corner.
Oh, wow.
There's a Mr. Sub. There's about 20 businesses.
And then a kick-ass artisan bakery. That's pretty wild. Yeah.
Well, I think we can claim bragging rights, maybe, but nothing else. Bragging rights that we're an anchor tenant, you know, that when you start seeing that the local real estate, speaking of real estate guys, are when they make mention of I guess it's a plus to promote the neighborhood to potential buyers of homes that, you know, that Cliffcrest Plaza has this bakery in it, and you know, they usually crib stuff that's off our website. You know, they don't come up with their own copy. That's okay. It doesn't bother me. It means that you've achieved, if not, you know, your financial dreams, but at least there's a level of acceptance and respect, or so, I suppose. Yeah. And I know neighborhood bakeries are, they're, as far as I'm concerned, and I think you would probably agree, that they're the way to go. And like, I'm not I don't see that the chains have done anything. Chains meaning the actual chains like Cobb's, or the in-store bakeries in grocery stores. Those are not. They are part of the baking industry, but they don't add. They don't add positive feedback loops into the community. There's much less of a connection. As opposed to, you know, like the best you could ever say about a neighborhood bakery is as an owner, and this has been written before, that on a good day, you can't tell who owns the place. You know, is this guy standing at the cash pontificating about whatever, or is it me that's standing back and watching it? Like it's cool when there's kind of a, you know, this kind of a gray, it's a cool gray area where people feel like it's their place, you know, that, and that's good. And I don't think you get that so much from Tim Hortons or
not at all. I'm exactly with you. It's like you're part of the fabric of the community.
I
guess my thing is that or my going in assumption is that's part of the big goal of why we get into this. You know, like it's a love of food, but it's that love of just being part of the community where you're making the food, right?
And yes, where you're a provider. In this case, you know, you're not the butcher, you're the baker, providing the bread. And there's, you know, there's less so in North America, but you know, Europe is always glamorized, at least the romance of, you know, the German / Italian / French bakery. And I think North Americans, Canadians in particular, because we have this giant neighbor to the south that swallows up a lot of the media attention. But it is really, if you delve into, I like history. I love finding out about bakeries that were around in Toronto in 100 years ago.
It
shows you that the tradition, although Canada is a very different place geographically and culturally from Europe, that came over here and it was practiced hammer and tongs by all those newcomers that came. All those Ukrainians, all those Scottish people, Irish, Germans, all down the line, you know. You ever heard of the book, The Bread Ovens of Quebec?
Oh, I've heard of it. I've never seen it, but I've...
It's not in print.
Yeah.
But a woman that I knew years ago had a copy. It's only about 60 pages long. It's a very slim volume. I guess it was probably published by an academic, and it shows this little map of Quebec where these bread, you know, like little dots on the map, and you see how modest this stuff was. These things were built for sustenance. They were not built as commercial enterprises, at least not on anything that we would recognize in today's baking culture as a profit place, you know, mostly run by women with babies on their hips as they're peeling loaves into the oven. That gives you a lot of respect for the people that came that did it under much more technologically difficult conditions, you know, pre-electricity, pre-mixers, pre-refrigeration. That's a big one. How the hell did bakers ever exist without refrigeration?
It's funny. I've seen that book referenced, especially when I was building my oven, right? Like a lot of folks kind of bring that book up, but I've never actually seen it. It puts me to mind of, you know, you're baking for the people in your community. You're part of it. And it's the staples. And it's the holiday stuff. It's the neat treat. And that's why I always think of, you know, hot cross buns, because you brought it up, are sort of our nemesis at the bakery as well. Same kind of thing with the demand and how do you fit them in the schedule? And I stay up all night before Easter baking off hot cross buns and stuff. But But it was like, but that was the thing that, you know, you could just see it in people's eyes that the story that they were telling themselves about this product, right? This baked good. And it's so neat to me because it's like, it's not gimmicky. It's sort of, it's that traditional thing. It's not like, every once in a while I'll get an email, like a spam or something about, you know, the hot trends in 2023 baking, you know, and it's like, it's, I don't know, M&Ms or something. It's like, oh, for God's sake.
Yeah.
That's not the story that our customers were telling themselves when they were coming by. And
yes.
And I'm assuming it's the same for you.
Yes. I connect far less with, the trends. Panettone, I'm not bad mouthing Panettone, but you know, Panettone to me is, it's the latest thing. Sourdough Panettone.
Yeah.
But I'm not Italian. I didn't grow up with that. Every time I don't mind Italian, Panettone, but, it's dried out stuff. Right. And I think it's more of a hostess gift, you know, they bring this big box with Panettone. So I don't connect to it. It's not something I desire to delve into. I don't have the time for it. So, you know, like this thing about shaving off, making the process leaner and leaner. It's partly that, and it's not to badmouth Panettone, but it's become a real trend. Even as sourdough, when we started off when we opened in 2011, we didn't dare call our breads sourdough breads. We absolutely avoided that phrase. It was Michael Pollan's Netflix special. It was a 3-part special, and one of the modules was sourdough bread. And God bless him. Like I think I have no problem at all. We were able to pivot on that phrase, but we were very, very leery in using anything with the word sour in it. And so it was puzzling to me. I did, but you know, I remain puzzled, but I'm okay with it. If that's what, if now sourdough is an accepted thing, it's what every tech nerd did with their spare time during the pandemic. Great. The more the merrier. I think everybody should bake bread. Everybody should have, you know, it's a life skill. You know, leave the, you know, the larger production to professional bakers. Absolutely. But go ahead and show your stuff off on Instagram. I'm glad there's a lot of that going on. I think
it's yeah. Oh, for sure. It kind of gets because for everybody that's baking it at home and sharing their bread and stuff, you're going to get people turned on saying, okay, I'm not going to make it. Where can I find this?
Yes.
And that's when they're going to find your place and you go, right? Yeah.
Well, and I'm waiting for those people.
Well,
and they do come. I'm not saying that, like, I'm still waiting, but
many people try it and they realize, you know what, this is far too much work. There's too much science involved in this. I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
I think I'll just buy it.
Yeah. But I always find then, like, it's places like your place and our place was that you can, you know, you're open to having the conversations if when folks are interested and they're curious about what you're doing. Here it is. You can see it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You can see how things are made. Like, and that's fantastic. And it raises the game for everyone for sure.
Yes. You know?
Well, and you mentioned Panettone, and it's funny because I'm very much like, we have a lot in common, although my friend Tracy Mussolini in Saskatoon, I will drive for hers when she makes it at Christmas time, because it's like something she's been making for years and years and years, and it's part of her heritage and that kind of thing.
It's authentic, yeah.
And it's like, so bring it on. And she still makes her dad, well, her dad comes in still in his 80s and makes the fruitcake that he made on the CN rail kind of a thing. And it's like, give me some of that fruitcake all the time, would love it.
You like fruitcake?
Oh, man. I'm the only one in my entire family that likes fruitcake, and I love it. And so I get it all to myself.
I dislike it when it gets maligned.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I mean,
I take it as a personal affront, and I have to really watch myself because, you know, usually I just let it slide because it's usually on social media that you see stuff like that. So I just scroll by. I don't make a comment anymore. But you know, there's fruitcake and then there's fruitcake.
Yeah.
There's fruitcake that's better than other fruitcake. But I would, for me, I like it so much that I'll even eat bad fruitcake because bad fruitcake, it's still made by professional bakers.
Yeah.
It's not made by people that are, you know, tripping over each other in a kitchen somewhere. It's made deliberately, you know.
Yeah. Like
it's a poor man's version of fruitcake. It's still, there's something to it that's enjoyable to me. The fact that it's fruitcake. You know?
I was going to ask you when I looked at your menu on the website. There's an awful lot of German breads, or it certainly seemed in there. Like,
yeah.
So where'd that all kind of come from?
That's from Loblaws.
That's because you mentioned earlier the German bakers you worked with.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Well, at George Brown, I was there for 4 years and I had there was two German bakers and one Austrian baker. And they just have this very, you know, it's disciplined. Mm-hmm. There's no horse shit involved. Now there's, you know, there's an arrogance,
yeah,
which is, you know, for all kinds of different reasons. So that really influenced me. Like I was a very disordered person, you know, just personally, I was disordered. I was unorganized, and an unorganized baker. If you're an unorganized baker, you're always going to be the guy at the bottom, right? So it forced me to acquire some discipline. Then when I went to Loblaws, Christ, if I thought I met Germans at George Brown, then I started ran into a whole handful of them, and every single one of them had come from Berlin. They are all Berliners.
Mm-hmm.
So Berliners have a sort of this dark, twisted, black sense of humor that translates for me. It translated really well into this. It was sort of this, you know, they were all exceptional craftsmen. They all had come up from being 10 years old and gone into apprenticeship. They get them early over there. We don't have that culture over here. That's a shame. And yet this sort of disrespect, and especially for authority, you know, I'm working at Loblaws, there's lots of layers of authority that we had to succumb to. And so I just gravitated towards all that stuff. Also, I wanted to mention Jeffrey Hamelman in his book, Bread. He sort of leans the same way. Like he's got this big thing, you know, an affinity, I guess you might say, for German baking culture. So I went down to King Arthur in 2008 when I was still working for Loblaws. I managed to get a month off. And again, they had no knowledge of this. And I went down and took a week-long advanced baking course. And I thought, am I advanced enough? And I found that I was no problem. But it was an awesome experience, you know, baking with Jeffrey for a whole week. I was very impressed. And again, you know, this thing about order, it really it came through. So a lot of his breads that were in the book Bread, you know, I adapted them. They became my breads. So like they're a little bit different, but they you know, anyone asks, that's I always attribute a lot of the inspiration, or even for, you know, having the gumption to publish a book on bread. Like that's a big undertaking.
I still refer to that thing. I've got such a beaten up copy.
Same that
I still
me.
Rely on. And it's just the best. Yeah.
It's the Bible. You know, I had learned baker's percentage when I went back, when I was in baking school in the 90s, but there was no, there was no opportunity to put it to use in the grocery store at all. So it lapsed. It fell by the wayside. I forgot about it. And when I got back into it, I didn't care about it. But when I read, and even when I read Peter Reinhardt's book, as good as that book was and as inspirational it was, it did not have a technical solidity to it that Jeffries did. When Jeffries' book came out, and I saw the arrangement of the formulas, I called up my brother. My brother's a fantastic math whiz. And I said, I want you to help me design and he did it in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
but that has been sort of like the foundational, any success that I've had as a baker, not as a businessman, just as a straight baker, has to do with being able to control the batch sizes correctly.
Yeah.
And I've delved into it far more than I ever thought I would. And I get a big kick out of just writing formulas. If I find a recipe that's written, you know, in a sort of a non-technical way on you know, Spruce Eats, or whenever you're doing a Google search for something that you want to make, I make a point of formulizing it. And it's actually turned out to be a little bit of a skill.
Yeah.
That, you know, that you can work on, you could get better at it, and you start to notice things that you never noticed before. Anyway, so I won't prattle on about that, but Jeffrey was really, really influential.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my pre-Loblaws baking experience was not in bread. It was in sweet goods shops and pastry shops, and I was dying to learn how to make bread. It's funny that I was dying to make bread, so I went and worked at Loblaws. They were never known as good bread, even in the scratch bakery. The scratch bakeries were all made with no-time doughs, and there was no, you know, the sourdoughs were Puratos mixes out of a bag, you know.
So
I don't have any great love for that style of baking, and I still kind of get a little pissed off whenever I run across, because, you know, you get sent promotional materials. Baker's Journal always sends you, you know, like a yearly calendar that's sponsored by Puratos, and if you start following them, you'll start thinking, you know, that it's like baking for dummies or something like that. And like, they're a conglomerate. I can't argue with their success, but that style of non-scratch, or sort of fake scratch baking, that's what I would call it, it's not for me. Even the sourdough library, I'm critical of that. I think that was more about data gathering than anything else.
I gotcha. I'm right with you there. It's so funny. I've learned that there's such a wide realm, or such a wide continuum of what's being produced, and there's not enough words to describe it all. So it starts to blend together, and then so it just causes so much confusion for the average eater to know what it is they're getting, you know. And that's it's the smaller guys like us that kind of get up in arms about it the most, because we're the ones that have to sort of explain why what we're doing is so different, and why it justifies a higher price, and all of those things.
I know. I've been through a lot of that. Why does your bread cost so much? And, you know, like when you're challenged, and you've just baked a big whack of stuff and spent the night, and then somebody challenges you that way, it can go south really, really quickly. And you want to make sure that it doesn't. A friend of mine, I use this quote so many times. A friend of mine, grew up a Macedonian family, immigrant family. They ran a diner. The diner's actually done really, really well. It's been there for almost 60 years. His dad came in the 60s. And, you know, his dad is gone now, bless his heart. But his dad had this phrase, smile and take their money. It's the simplest of phrases. But to execute it, is it ever hard? It's hard to do that.
Yeah.
because sometimes you don't want to smile when someone challenges you, you know, in regards to the price or any number of other
things. Oh yeah, no, I got.
And you have to, you have to be diplomatic, because otherwise you'll close. Because you know, it's word of mouth. That's even with social media, I still maintain a brick and mortar business is word of mouth, and you can't Rogers your way out of, you know, calling it customer service when it's not. So
yep, no, nope. I hear you. I hear you. Cool. Ah, so neat. I'm so glad that we connected up here. This has been so much fun to talk with you and to talk with you both. And I wish you a huge success on your terms come in the year coming up here once you get back into the shop, and just really, really thrilled with everything that you're doing and sort of your whole mindset for your bakery and that. I feel so good for you too, and then I feel really, really good for the folks in your neighborhood. So it's
thanks.
Oh wow, that was so much fun! Everything from brick ovens to small bakeries to hot cross buns being the bane of our existence to fruitcake, everything. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I really think when I listened to it as the second time, I thought, oh, wow. You know, if we had kept Orange Boot Bakery running, we would be like David and Camelia today. They sound like pretty awesome people, and it felt kind of good to imagine what our retail bakery would have looked like 12 or 13 years in. And I just love all the stuff that they're doing. When Camelia was taking us through sort of all the ways that they've added to the menu without expanding their space and just getting more efficient and bringing in things from the family farm and making things for the freezer case and just doing what they have to do to keep feeding the people in their community, that just warmed my heart. It really did. And then when David started talking about all of the other bakers that have influenced him over the years, from like Peter Reinhardt to Jeffrey Hamelman, who I have to say, so I listen to a lot of podcasts. I listen to a lot of creative podcasts, and you don't get through too many episodes before somebody starts bringing up Bob Dylan. And then they go on for a little bit about how unique and awesome and creative Bob Dylan is. And I think in the baking world, you don't talk too long in the baking world without bringing up Jeffrey Hamelman and how influential and creative and genuinely nice and interesting Jeffrey is. And so it's happened again. So for the 43rd time on this show, we're talking about Jeffrey, and I don't regret it for a second. I will talk about Jeffrey every show if that's what it takes, because he's awesome. And it was so cool that David believes that as well. So there you go. That's all for this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. I should have one next week, but at this point, it's a little up in the air about getting some interviews scheduled, but I'm going to do my best. Until we talk again, have a great time. Bake lots. Work hard. Come out to the Bakers for Bakers call. If you're in Victoria, come out to the Baking Association of Canada Town Hall. But even if you're just in your bakery, bake away, feed the people. Happy baking. Bye-bye.